Steve Fishman, welcome back to the Killer Cross-Examination Podcast. You know why we are here. You know what I want to talk to you about, right?
I've got a pretty good idea.
All right. So, Steve, you've tried hundreds of cases in state and federal court. I don't think there's anybody that has better experience both on defending police officers who've been accused of certain misconduct before juries, cross-examining police officers who have engaged in wrongdoing, and representing people of color who have been the target of, we'll just say, discriminatory police practices. And so that together really tells me that it's a subject that I really just wanted to touch upon with you. I wanted to get into it. And so I couldn't think of a better person to talk to about it. And so here we are.
Okay.
So Steve, I know your experience, I know your background, and I know you're familiar with all of the cases involving, and ones we've heard about recently. Let's see, I'm gonna go through a list. We've got Andre Hill, Dante Wright, Breonna Taylor, Manuel Ellis. The list keeps going on and on and on. George Floyd, obviously. What is going on?
Well, I think there are a number of things going on, but the first and most important thing that's going on is that you've got video and you've got dash cams and you've got body cams and you have people in the street who have their phones with them and they're taping and they're picking up the conversation as well as the behavior. That's the single biggest difference between how things are now and how they were almost 50 years ago when I started out in this business. In those days, the coppers could come in and say pretty much whatever they wanted. And, you know, it required cross-examination skills because oftentimes there weren't really any witnesses around. It isn't like it's been today, these days. And you really had to cross-examine them and show the jury that basically they were telling a story that wasn't true. Or you had to show a judge if you had a motion to suppress evidence, you have to show a judge that just based on a cross-exam, and every now and then you could put your client on a stand. But the whole world was different because you didn't have video and audio. That's the first thing. The second thing is that the one consistent thing I think you see in all of these cases, and this is, in my view, the most important thing, all of these cases from George Floyd to Dante White, even including Breonna Taylor, these are situations that probably never should have even begun. All of them involve minor, well, Breonna Taylor is a different one. We'll talk about that. But it's not just traffic stops. George Floyd was not a traffic stop. What you see is, you see police officers getting involved in incidents that are not worth police officers' time. And because of the nature of police training, which I think is part of the problem, a small thing like maybe there was a counterfeit 20, turns into 9.5 minutes of kneeling on the man's neck and murdering him. I think that a lot of that stems from pressure put on the line, police officers to make X number of arrests, to issue X number of tickets. You know, there are communities out there, I don't know that it happens in big cities, but there are communities out there that rely for part of their budget, you know, on payment of traffic tickets and things of that nature. So when you're stopping a guy like Dante White because I think his license plate was expired or some ridiculous
right.
thing.
Right, Dante Wright.
You know, just, the next thing
he's
you know.
20 years old. I mean, he's 20 years old.
The point is that I think what needs to be done and what needs to occur is you have to make sure that the training that police officers go through emphasizes the notion that, look, we're trying to get crooks. We're trying to catch real crooks. We're not trying to catch a guy who might have floated a phony 20. Why would you possibly have to take George Floyd to jail? You get his ID, you look into it. As it turned out from the trial, the man who called in, the clerk, he never wanted anything to happen. He just called in because that's what he was told to do. The odds are overwhelming. If they had told him, well, you got to come down, you're going to have to sign it, he'd have said, oh, the hell with it, who cares? And that had been the end of the George Floyd incident. I think the same thing with these traffic stops. There's what's the one where they killed the guy? The guy had fallen asleep in line, I think at a McDonald's or something like that.
I think it was, was it, you know what? And here's the sad thing. I mean, I am trying to keep up on these cases. I know that there are people out there who have, I'll say it, that have black sons and are worried that they're reaching for a wallet or a license or a registration is going to be misinterpreted by the police.
You don't have to say people. I have a black son, and he and I had that conversation when he got his driver's license. There are any number of other reasons. I told him to be very careful out there, and I basically told him you almost have to strip search your friends in case they got a joint or who the hell knows what before you let them in the vehicle with you. So I don't need to hear about what happens with other people with black sons because I got one, okay? But the point I'm trying to make is that I think that, you know, all this talk about what they need to do about the police, what the police need to do, I think you really need a reorientation of police thinking so that when they're being trained in the academy or when they're being taught by their superior officers, instead of having a Derek Chauvin who gives the absolute, or this lady, you know, I think her last name was Potter, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes. Yep.
Instead of having people like that doing the training, you have to have somebody who's, and I think in Detroit, in all honesty, I think it's a lot better. I think you got a lot of people in sergeants and lieutenants positions who work the streets, who know what's important and what's not. They're obviously trying to get as many guns as they can off the street. But at the same time, I've got to believe that they communicate or attempt to communicate to the younger officers that, hey, you know, a guy starts speeding away, you know, going 60 in a 25 mile an hour zone. I don't care what it is. It ain't worth it because he's going to kill some innocent grandmother on her way across the street. And you just have to have a little more sense than that.
Dante Wright was stopped by officers for a traffic violation. The police tried to detain him for an outstanding warrant. Kim Potter is the officer we were talking about, shot him as he was trying to get back into his car. The police chief said it was an accident. Potter mistook her gun for her taser.
Well, I have an awful lot of retired police officers on Facebook with me because I know a lot of police officers. And the unanimous response to that claim was, are you kidding? Are you kidding? You can't tell the difference between your Glock and your taser. If you can't tell the difference between the Glock and the taser, you have no business walking a beat, let alone riding around in a squad car stopping people. That's crazy. And there have been examples through the years, long before there were body cams and dash cams, of police officers doing the right thing. In that situation, I don't watch television, as you know, but I did read the articles about that trial. And those officers, when they testified, I can't imagine the lawyers put them on the stand. If what was reported was accurate in terms of what they said, the cross-examination could have been 5 minutes. Literally, you saw what was happening. I don't care if he was there 20 years and it was your first day. You saw he was murdering the goddamn guy. So why didn't you just shove him off of him? There were three of you. What is he, Superman? I mean, that's the kind of stuff. Again, Neil, it goes back to the same thing. It's got to be the training. It's very easy for police officers to look at it, us against the world. That's a very common thing that police officers think. And if you look at it as us against the world, then you're a Chauvin who's got his knee on him. All these people around him are enemies. They're enemies. The ones with their cell phones, the ones that are looking, the ones that are telling him to stop, they're not regular people. They're enemies. That's how they look at it. And that's the stuff that needs to stop. And I do believe, I have to believe, that given the existence of body cams and dash cams, and as you're ticking off all of these incidents, I have to believe that as time goes on, it should get better. The training should get better. The sergeants, lieutenants, commanders, whatever you want to call them, the supervisors, are going to make sure these officers understand you can't do that stuff. That's not what we want you to do.
I want to show you a video, Steve. I'm sure you've seen this. If you haven't, now you can see one black kid and a white kid with this terrible haircut over here, right?
Yep.
What's that?
I can see it.
Okay.
Oh, shit. Yo. Chill. Brian, get up, man.
Okay, I see your point.
So how is this still possible today? Well, I mean, I know it's an open-ended question, but how?
If your question is, how is it possible that white people still look at black people as the automatic aggressor, and that white kids somehow are the victim of it? I mean, what universe have you been living in?
I'm looking at this, but let's break this down for a second. You have the police are literally over here. They run up, and they see one person who's actually on top of the other, right? First sign is you got the white kid on top of the black kid. So one is actually, you would think, is more vulnerable than the other. The police run up here and they pull off the white kid and they put him down on a couch. They then immediately begin to wrestle the black kid into a table.
I mean, you're right.
He's got him under control. And here's where it gets even worse. This is bad enough. The white kid's like, look what's going on. I mean, this kid, I had to deal with him. She's almost coddling him. Now the officer's got one arm around the black kid's neck, right? Now he's going to kneel on his back if we haven't learned anything at all from George Floyd. Then we always hear about officer safety, never turn your back on somebody. She turns her back on this other kid who's still on the couch. The kid on the ground is not resisting, obviously, right?
Right.
And then she's going to take her knee and put it up against his neck. And this kid is just still sitting here on the couch.
Right. Which tells you that the two of them are racist. That's what it tells you. The two cops are racist.
And then at one point when, watch this, you'll see he gets up. Now, you know what happened I hate to say this, Steve. I don't hate to say it. It is true. You and I both well know that if the tables were turned and someone who was in a fight, a black kid or a black male, stood up.
Well, there's no doubt about it. He'd be thrown on his ass and he'd be handcuffed. There's no doubt about it.
Okay. Now, he's walking around, they're looking at him. And then we get to a point as this video goes on, you'll see this kid sits back down. Now he, of course, probably thinks he's gonna be handcuffed. Look at the other kid's putting his hands up, but that doesn't happen.
As I said right at the beginning, I don't think this is stuff that didn't happen for as long as there's been this country. The difference is it's on TV, it's on body cams, it's on cell phones. This is not brand new that all of a sudden there's racism in America. I mean, it's a country founded on slavery, for God's sake. Who are we kidding? The only difference is everybody's getting to see it. So someone like you, who doesn't have the personal experience, let's say that I had when I was young, or that I certainly had with my son, you're justifiably appalled by it. But in the old days, all that stuff was happening. I mean, the Big Four used to drive around in Detroit and just mess with people for the hell of it. But there was no dash.
What's the Big Four?
The Big Four were four huge white guys that they call them the Big Four in every precinct. And if they stopped you, you better sit there like this and make sure you don't do anything, because otherwise your butt's getting beat. And it's just the way things are, the way things were. So I don't know that that what they're doing these days is anything that's different. What's changed is the fact that it's on video and the public has the ability to see it. And look at Neil, look at the convictions that we've seen recently. I know you're interested in knowing about whether or not cops can be convicted and whether or not white people can be convicted for murdering black people. There was one black juror in the Ahmaud Arbery case, one. And they convicted those three guys of murder, which is what it was. And the same thing in the case with the other three coppers with Chauvin.
And they just actually convicted them in federal court of a hate crime. So,
right.
Which it was.
Okay, so the judge is Asian, the defendant is white, and the victim is black. And, you know, you got to be, whatever nationality or ethnicity you are as a judge, you have to be cognizant of the fact that these people lost their son for absolutely no reason. So whatever sentence you're going to impose, it's the manner in which you're going to do it. For instance, I give you a perfect example from a judge that everybody knows, Judge Timothy Kenney, one of my very good friends for 50 years. Tim Kenney has the ability and always has had the ability to impose sentences in very, very difficult cases. Most state court sentences involve a victim. Forget CCW and carrying dope, but usually it's going to be a robbery or a rape or a homicide. And you have to have the ability, which Judge Kenney has always had, to impose a fair sentence, but at the same time recognize who's in front of you, not just the defendant, but also the victim, and not just the defendant's family, but the victim's family. It doesn't mean that you prostitute yourself, but it's the way in which you conduct court. Because I have never seen anybody leave Judge Kenney's court screaming and yelling about he was unfair from either side, because he talks in a way, which is what judges are supposed to do. Unfortunately, we got too many judges who don't do it that way. So they're difficult situations. It's that most, every judge will tell you sentencing is the most difficult thing that he or she has to do. But you have to have an ability to communicate to everybody that you care about the case, you've thought about the case, you've taken everybody's feelings into consideration, and then you're imposing a sentence that you believe is fair. You got to remember the biggest difference. I mean, there's a ton of differences between when I started doing this and even in the early 2000s and in the 90s, you know, when I had different police cases. The public attention now between social media and the dash cams and the body cams and everybody with their phone. And the fact that, for instance, you know, again, I don't watch it on television, but when I'm in the gym in the morning during those trials, these lawyers are going on television talking about the case while the case is going on. It's beyond my comprehension that the judges even allow it, number one. And you got to remember, almost all these cases are state court cases. So the cameras are in the courtroom, which they are not in federal court, thank God. And so people are performing for the cameras. And it's just, there are a lot of reasons why I'm kind of glad I'm coming to the end. One of them being I've had a lot of years of working, but I don't really like participating in all that stuff.
No, we still need you out here, Steve. We still need you.
I deal with the media and I get away with it, I suppose, because I'm older and I'm not trying to be on TV or in the newspaper, but I deal with them in my own way. And I don't allow them to get in the middle of me and get, you know, too close to everything. I just don't allow it. You know, I've represented a lot of people. It's not just police officers. I've represented athletes and politicians. And I tell the media every time the same thing. I remember being with Ben Wallace when we were in just the stinking district court over that pistol case. And everybody's there because he's Ben Wallace, right? And the case is a nothing case. It winds up being taken care of the way it should have been, which is a misdemeanor having a gun when you've had too much to drink, basically. But they were all over us. And we came out. And no, before we came out, I went out and talked. And, you know, I don't know most of these TV guys because I don't watch TV. And I said, look, fellas, let me make this real simple. And this is exactly how I said it. You want to have a conversation? Then you let Mr. and Mrs. Wallace go to their car. Don't stick a microphone in there. Don't chase after him. He's 6'8". You can't even jump high enough to get him to talk anyway. And I'll answer all your lousy questions. Do we have a deal? And I looked at every single one of them, and you could see some of them were reluctant, but they, yes. I said, fine, we'll see. When we came out, Ben and his wife walked through their car. Not one person followed after him, shouting, acting like a complete asshole like they can do. Why? Because, and then I said, you guys want to stay here for 2 hours? There's not much to talk about unless you want to talk about basketball. But that's how we did it. I don't think you can do that anymore. You know, I don't have state court trials anymore, but if you got that many people and all that television and all those people, you got to be a cold guy. I'd probably still be able to do it, I think. The best story I can tell you about dealing with the press happened at the end of the second weekly trial when he's been acquitted of the felony and it's down to hung jury. And I kind of knew they were going to dismiss it. And George Hunter of the News, who I know very well, they must have selected him. He comes up to me. We're waiting to discharge the jury. And he says, Steve, he says, look, here's what we want. We want you and Officer Weekly to come out in the front. We want you to answer some questions. We want to ask him some questions. And we want you to do that as soon as we get done. And I looked at him and I said, George, you know who the Rolling Stones are? And he goes, yeah, why? I said, well, then you know you can't always get what you want. And we went out the back door. That's the best one I can tell you.
I love it. All right. I want to put up a picture, ask you what you think and what your prediction is and what your feelings are about, you know who this is, of course, right? Ketanji Brown Jackson.
I definitely know who that is.
So Do you expect her to be confirmed? Good selection, bad selection from what you know about her? Do you expect her to be confirmed? Do you think she's going to be a good addition to the Supreme Court? Share your thoughts.
I think that it was long overdue to have a Black female on this court. I think she'll be confirmed because at least 50 Democrats are going to vote for her, but I believe more than that will. I think the hypocrisy displayed by the Ted Cruzes of the world, all of a sudden being horrified that the president said, my God, I'm going to put a Black female on there. I'm horrified about that. How horrified was he when they rushed Justice Barrett through in 2 weeks and all the other white people they rushed through? And he wasn't too horrified about that. Her background, I think it was a perfect appointment because her background is quite frankly what you see with everybody else. If it were up to me, I'd like to have a few people on the court that went to like Wayne, you know, rather than Harvard and Yale and all that stuff. But she did all of those things. And the one thing that drives them crazy, she worked at a defender office.
I don't know what happened to Yale, by the way. I mean, didn't Ron DeSantis go there?
Ron DeSantis went to either Yale or, Ron DeSantis is highly educated. But look, Hawley clerked for the Supreme Court. Do I think it'll matter? There was a great article by Linda Greenhouse yesterday in the New York Times about the fact that she's hopeful, and maybe a false hope, she's hopeful that Justice, soon to be Justice Jackson, will bring to the table, she used as an example Thurgood Marshall and Sandra Day O'Connor. And how Sandra Day O'Connor, of course, was almost the direct opposite. Obviously, she was a white privileged female. She came from Arizona. She really didn't believe in the state imposing too much of anything. But she became very close with Thurgood Marshall. Why? Because she was so fascinated about his background and all the things he had lived through and da-da-da-da-da. I think Justice Jackson, even though it doesn't sound like she came up, you know, on Mack and Bewick, but she's still a Black woman who had to live as a Black woman in a white, pretty much racist society for her entire life. And look what she's accomplished. I just think it's a great thing. And the criticism of Biden for announcing ahead of time he was intending to appoint a Black female is just beyond my comprehension. It's just totally, I mean, who are these people to pretend that this is an equal opportunity society? Are they kidding? Are they kidding? I mean, look at some of the judges without calling them by name.
The hypocrisy is just, it's almost to the point that the hypocrisy is just, it drowns out everything else. We've got Tucker Carlson. Here, Steve, what was your LSAT score? Like if someone actually came to you and said, Steve, here's the decision whether or not you should hire somebody. Here are four resumes. If three of the resumes had LSAT scores on them, I know exactly what you do with those two resumes. You would probably call the person that recommended them, or you call the kid and say, listen, you may have a very bright future, but it's not going to be with me. You should never put your LSAT score on your resume. Don't even ever bring it up.
Well,
I think in law school, that's all that mattered.
I think when you're talking about a guy like Carlson, see, Carlson doesn't even pretend not to be a racist. I mean, you know, he's a TV personality. He's not a senator. These other guys got to kind of waltz around it and pretend they're not really. It's not really that, you know, it's just a matter of why would he say it that way and blah, blah, blah. Carlson's just an out and out racist. So he's comfortable saying anything because it doesn't matter. He wouldn't be so comfortable. But what I always say about guys like him is I'd like to have taken him with me and let's go back on Roselawn and Margarita and let him talk the way he talks in our neighborhood and see how he gets along then. You know, it's like Trump and Bill Barr were bullies in high school, really? Were they at Northeastern High and Mumford High and, you know, in Central? I don't think so. It's the same thing with him. But back to your original question, I think it's going to be terrific. And I don't know why I'm optimistic. I think there's going to be a decent amount. Five or six Republicans will vote for her, in my opinion. That's what I think.
From your mouth, what's the saying? Alibi from your mouth.
Alibi. That's alibi. It.
From your mouth alibi. To God's ears. Steve Fishman, it's always great to catch up with you. I know that I've taken up a lot of your time tonight. I appreciate it. I'm going to circle back again in a month or two as more subjects come up and talk about a variety of things. But you're someone that I value your opinion. I value your commentary, your humor, and most of all, You know, I get to actually have you on, and I get to ask you questions and you answer them. And to me, that's as close as it's going to come to me ever for questioning you.
All right. Well, it was a good time. Anyway, I enjoyed it.
Steve, I appreciate it. It was a great talk, and I appreciate it, man. Thanks for coming on Killer Cross Examination, the incomparable Steve Fishman, everyone.
All right.